This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may recognize David Rakoff as a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He's the guy who spent one Christmas as the anti-Santa, posing as Sigmund Freud in the window of the department store Barney's. Rakoff also writes for Outside and the New York Times Magazine and has written for Salon and Harper's Bazaar. Now Rakoff has a new collection of very funny essays called Fraud. He's also co-starring off-Broadway in Amy and David Sedaris' latest play, The Book of Liz. David Sedaris says about Rakoff's new book, with Fraud, David Rakoff manages to successfully pass himself off as the wittiest and most perceptive man in the world. Let's start with a reading from the first essay in the book.
I do not go outdoors. Not more than I have to. As far as I'm concerned, the whole point of living in New York City is indoors. You want greenery? Order the spinach. Paradoxically, I'm about to climb a mountain on Christmas Day with a man named Larry Davis. Larry has climbed Mount Monadnock in southwestern New Hampshire every day for the last 5+ years. I will join him on ascent number 2065. The trip up to New Hampshire will involve a tiny plane from Boston. I tear my medicine cabinet apart like Billie Holiday and still only uncover one Xanax. The hiking boots the Outdoor Adventure magazine sent me to buy, large, ungainly, potato-like things that I have been trying to break in for the past 4 days, cut into my feet and draw blood as if they were lined with cheese graters. I have come to hate these timberlands with a fervor I usually reserve for people. Just think, the shoes I wouldn't be caught dead in might actually turn out to be the shoes I am caught dead in.
That's David Rakoff reading the first piece in his new collection, Fraud. What were you doing climbing this mountain?
Well, I was, there is this fellow in southwestern New Hampshire who was climbing Mount Monadnock every day, and he had done so for 5 years. And the folks at Outside Magazine thought they would send someone on the day that seemed most unlikely to climb a mountain. Christmas Day, you know, other than one's birthday or Mother's Day or your anniversary. And they thought, well, who can we send on Christmas Day? And, you know, certainly I identify as Jewish and I don't celebrate Christmas. And I, you know, I was free. And they also thought that it would be kind of funny since they knew that I don't really, I'm not much of a mountain climber. You know, I'm not much of an outdoorsman at all. They like that disconnect as well. So they sent me off for a Christmas climb, and there was an ice storm in the middle of it.
How'd you do in the ice storm?
I did all right in the ice storm, although there was a little bit of a testosterone contest, which is once you get above the tree line, things, you know, above the tree line means there are no trees, so all there is bare rock. And when ice is falling on bare rock, it tends to sort of glaze it in a somewhat dangerous, perilous fashion. And I had been outfitted by the fellow I was climbing with and his two friends with all this apparatus. Among the things that were in my backpack were a pair of crampons, which are those, you know, clawed little things that you put on your shoes. And I was climbing. I ended up not wearing those Timberlands. I wore my own pair of shoes, which were from the Payless Shoe Source, and they're made out of plastic. So they're not the greatest things you would climb a mountain in, but they suited me fine until we got to this glazed rock, and I thought, well, terrific, thank goodness for those crampons, let's all put them on, shall we? And they wouldn't, and there was this little bit of a, am I allowed to say pissing contest on the radio?
Go ahead.
Oh, there was a little bit of a pissing contest that I didn't participate in. I never, you know, obviously didn't say, may we put on our crampons, because I was also there as ostensibly as a journalist. It really wasn't about me. But that we didn't put on the crampons, and it got rather tough going right near the summit. Our progress was somewhat slowed down because it's hard to find purchase on icy rock.
So is the piece that you just read from the piece you wrote for Outside Magazine, or is this behind the piece behind the piece that you wrote for Outside Magazine?
This is behind the piece. This is, you know, the highs and the lows behind the piece. This is more of an examination of being sent as an outdoor journalist when, in fact, I had no business doing so.
What made you decide to write that?
It was an out, outcropping, the natural outcropping of the fact that when I take notes, when I'm doing a story and I do so voraciously, I can't stop the wisecracks. And it was also so much at the forefront of my mind. I was far more, it's sad and somewhat arrogant to admit it, I was far more interested in what I was feeling at that time, it being my first piece, than in the actual mechanics of the reporting. It was so much on my mind that this was an experience that I had not had theretofore, and that I should really try and document it. And I also thought that the jokes I was coming up with were pretty good, and it sort of seemed like natural material.
Now, in the piece, when you're talking about, you know, how ridiculous you feel as a journalist covering this mountain climber, you say that you feel like a fraud. And you write, the central drama of my life is actually about being lonely and staying thin, but fraudulence gets a fair amount of play.
Yes.
Now, there are so many people, interesting people in your acknowledgments, that it's hard to imagine you as really being that lonely. Are you also a fraud at being lonely, or is that really a part of your life?
Well, you know, loneliness, I think, is an interesting thing that is not... it's not entirely a bad thing, first of all, being lonely. Moreover, I don't think it's the kind of thing that's entirely corrected by the company of other people. You know, one feels, and I certainly also haven't cornered the market on loneliness, but I think that you can feel untethered and adrift in the middle of a crowded room full of one's dear, wonderful friends. And as you pointed out, I have been the recipient of extraordinary friendship over my life. And certainly, in that sense, I'm well cared for. But that doesn't really go the full distance in counteracting loneliness. But I don't know that that loneliness is eradicable in a way. I think it's something that will always be with one, like double-jointedness or good turnout.
My guest is David Rakoff, and he has a new collection of his essays called Fraud, and he writes for many places and also is a contributor to This American Life. Now, David, in addition to writing, you act, and you've been, among other things, in several pieces written by David and Amy Sedaris.
Yes.
And you've also had some small parts in films and TV shows, though I think some of these parts were probably left on the cutting room floor.
Almost invariably, yes. I've been cut out of some very august projects. So.
One of your pieces in your new collection, Fraud, is about a small part you had in a daytime soap. And you say in the piece, you know that soap fans would have killed to be on the set with you, but you don't watch these programs. You had no idea who the actors were. And so you like being in their presence didn't mean a thing to you. Isn't it strange to be with people who you know are really famous in some circles and you have no idea who they are?
It's very strange. And they were extremely conscious of the fact that soap opera fame is fame of a very specific sort. It's actually not unlike public radio fame. You know, there's a very strict subculture to these things. So these people were, to a man and woman, gorgeous New York acting folk. I mean, they were beautiful. They had attenuated limbs and perfect skin. And, you know, when we were in the rehearsal room in the morning, all their signifiers were incredibly stylish and urban. There was one woman in a pair of black cigarette pants and a black beret. I mean, she looked like Faye Dunaway and Bonnie and Clyde. And she was just fantastic looking. But there was this vague sense of apology for the fact that they seemed to understand that the nature of their fame was exurban, out there, you know, among a very specific group and, you know, multitudes, but a very specific group of daytime television watchers. And they didn't seem to comport themselves with the kind of, well, I'm just terribly famous and you should have heard who I am. You know, they immediately saw me for what I was, which is, I mean, at that point, I guess I came in as an actor in New York City. It never would have occurred to them that I would have watched the soap opera.
What was your part on the soap?
I played a modeling agent from the big city. I think I played a modeling agent from New York City, in fact, or Chicago. I think it was New York. And I was passing through the town the fictional town that this soap opera took place in. And apparently, although I'd never been on the soap opera before, I pass through that town a lot, you know, because I'm always checking out what's happening there fashion-wise. Seems to be a hotbed of fashion, apparently. And there was a fashion show, and I was at the country club, which is the main set, you know, the place where they all congregate to act out the little dramas. And there was a fashion show there, and I was just checking things out, and I see one of the town lovelies, you know, I can't remember her name. I think I gave her a pseudonym, obviously, in the book. I didn't want to incriminate anyone. And I see her, and I am deeply interested in her, in both a professional and, I thought, you know, it helped my character, a possibly sort of predatory, vulpine kind of way. And I'm insinuatingly unctuous, and I try and get her to, you know, leave this podunk two-horse town and follow me to New York City or Chicago, I can't remember, and participate in this small but terribly important fashion show that I'm organizing. And she rejects my advances, but I am, you know, slitheringly immune to, you know, the cold shoulder, and I then leave. I never appeared again, sadly.
Did you have any great lines in the part that stick out in your mind?
I'm trying to remember my lines. It was something like, I feel like I'm discovering a new talent. I mean, the way you wear a dress, your look, just things like that. Just fantastically good, slimy. Yeah, he was a slime ball. And I was wearing my own clothes, of course, because they give you $10 extra if you bring your own costume.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, so I was acting with my house keys on my person.
Huh.
Which was...
Now, did you look different from the rest of the cast because they're all these afternoon soap stars and you're not?
I looked so very different from the rest of the cast. It was really, you know, they're gorgeous. They're not just pretty. They're heart-stoppingly beautiful people. Their faces are mathematically precise, you know, cross-culturally beautiful. And I am, in a word, not. So it, you know, I also have a certain kind of ethnic look. I have a certain careworn Jewish quality to my face. So, yeah, I did sort of stand out in that way. Happily, there were a lot of extras at this particular episode because they were playing the other people in the audience at the fashion show. And they all tended to be senior citizens because there's this vast network of lonely seniors in New York whose kick is to go be extras at soap operas. They all knew one another, and they had all clearly worked on all the other soaps that played in New York, that filmed in New York. So they all knew one another. And then there was me, and then there was this aesthetic super race.
My guest, David Rakoff, is the author of a new collection of funny essays called Fraud. One of his pieces is about his adventures acting in a daytime soap. You write in your piece that the typical parts you get are either Jewy McHebrew or Fudgy Packer. Would you describe
Fudgy McPacker? Yes.
Fudgy McPacker, yeah. Would you
describe? Scots. they're two Scottish clans. Well, the McHebrews are a your prototypical Jewish clan. So that's I'm either sent for one of two parts. I no longer really act with any frequency except for the Seder. I don't get sent on auditions, but I Jewy McHebrew is generally a kind of a careworn. I already said, careworn twice in the same interview. I'm so sorry. But he's a kind of inquiring, furrowed-browed, bookish type who can either be the kind of guy who, and he speaks rather quickly with the kind of inquiring people of the word, people of the book, and he says things like, with dentated final consonants. So he says, Papa, I can't believe it. You sold the store? Or he plays the kind of humanist rabbi type who says, you know, and so we eat the bitter herbs. Why? Because it is to remember the bitterness of in Egypt. You know, that's the Jewy McHebrew type, generally. Or he's a psychiatrist. They're like, how do you understand that? Whereas Fudgy McPacker is, you know, the gay character. And he can take a various variety of forms. There's, you know, supercilious Fudgy McPacker, and he's generally a hotel concierge or a makeup clerk or a waiter, and he drawls. He's more like, no, we're not carrying that this season. Next. You know, and he's just too bored, too cool for school. But there's the other Fudgy McPacker type who is gaining great currency right now culturally. And he is the lovable queen who everybody loves. He gets the best lines. He's replaced, for want of a better term, the fat girl within the dramatic pantheon. You know, Fudgy McPacker, the funny one, now gets the best lines. Like, did somebody say swim team? And, you know, that becomes his catchphrase, and they put that on T-shirts, and then he's, you know, 10 years hence, he's opening malls, and he's a bitter, bitter, bitter sociopath as a result.
A bitter McPacker.
It's a bitter McPacker. Fudgy McBitter. And, or the other one is he's dispensing clear-eyed, you know, romantic advice, not being privy to romance himself because, of course, you know, he has no actual sexuality. And he says things like, can't you see he's in love with you? Just tell him. You know, and then they kiss, and then it's cut to Fudgy McPacker, and he sort of cocks his head. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not cut to Fudgy McPacker. It's cut to the dog. And the dog cocks his head and goes, yeah, and cue the dog, or cue Fudgy McPacker. Either way, terrific, terrific parts to get and be sent on, which is essentially why I stopped being an actor.
Well, what would you do when you were cast in a part that was obviously a stereotype? You knew the voice of the stereotype. You could do the stereotype perfectly.
And I wouldn't do it. And resultantly, I didn't get many parts. And I also, you know, wasn't... I didn't... Frequently, when I would be asked to audition for things, I would decline to even go into the audition. And, you know, if you do that enough times, then you stop being asked, which is precisely what happened for me, which was okay. I mean, it was essentially a conscious choice on my part, you know, not to do that.
So what's the problem that when casting directors see you, all they can think of is Dewey McKeebrew or Fudgy McPacker?
Essentially, yeah. Essentially. I think that it's their, and this is not to say anything against casting directors. I think there's kind of generally a kind of a risk aversion. Less so on stage. You know, on stage you can be a number of things. Currently I'm in this play by Amy and David Sedaris that's running till June 1st in New York, and I get to play four different characters. And only one of them is, in fact, Fudgy McPacker, but because it's written by David, it's a joy to play. You know, it's a comment on that entire genre. But the other people that I play are, you know, a very stern kind of deacon in a quasi-Amish order, and the other one is a cockney football hooligan with a heart of gold, and the other one is the, you know, coverall-wearing Lenny from Of Mice and Men, Soul of the Working Class, you know, sweetheart doofus. You know, so on stage there's a great deal more latitude. But in television and movies, let's face it, there's an enormous amount of money riding on these things. And so a certain risk aversion is only expected. You know, I don't blame them. But there's not, as a result, a terrible abundance of imagination in terms of casting.
David Sedaris has a quote on the jacket of your book, recommending the book, you know, a blurb. And Sedaris writes, on first meeting him, I was struck by his ability. He's talking about you. On first meeting him, I was struck by his ability to impersonate any living creature and retain long stretches of movie dialogue. He's a human tape recorder. Do you think of yourself that way?
It's certainly always been something I could do from childhood. You know, and there's, I think it's just one of those, like, double-jointed things. Yeah, I always manage to get dialogue for some reason.
Are there certain movie scenes that were really significant to you when you were young that you memorized and that just are kind of permanent part of your memory now?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's that scene where, I mean, and now, of course, I'm going to have to paraphrase, and various Double Indemnity fans all over are going to be writing WHYY. He got that wrong! But it's, when Fred McMurray as Walter Neff comes to meet Phyllis Dietrichson, played by Barbara Stanwyck, and her wheels are turning, and she's understanding finally that she has an out from this loveless marriage. She could make a lot of money. And he's in turn interested in her because she's this sultry, blonde pistol of a thing, you know, who's come in barely dressed by the standards of that time. And he's making a pass at her, and she finally tells him that, you know, her husband is going to be there tomorrow night when he can come back and see him. And he says, "Your husband?" She said, "You were interested in seeing him, weren't you?" And he says, "Well, I was, but it's kind of wearing off, if you know what I mean." She says, "There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff." "Oh, really, officer? How fast was I going?" "I'd say about 90. Suppose you get off your bike and give me a ticket. Suppose I let you off with a warning. Suppose you wrap me across the knuckles." Oh, damn, I got it all wrong, Terry. Oh, God. It's in my wallet, but I'm not carrying my wallet today because it's so hot. So
it's
I'm only
in your
carrying
wallet?
Money and ID, yeah.
Why is it in your wallet?
Oh, you know, should I meet my maker in front of a bus and people can rifle through my wallet and see that I was the kind of terribly interesting person who kept a page of Double Indemnity dialogue in my wallet. And then they could say, "What a waste." I've no idea actually why it's in my wallet, but it is actually in my wallet. And I will occasionally take it out and, you know, read it like a little mantra. Oh.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
If psychoanalysis was late 19th century secular Judaism's way of constructing spiritual meaning in a post-religious world, and retail is the late 20th century's way of constructing meaning in a post-religious world, what does it mean that I'm impersonating the father of psychoanalysis in a store window to commemorate a religious holiday?
That's David Rakoff reading from Christmas Freud about the Christmas that he impersonated Sigmund Freud in the window of a Manhattan department store. It's one of the essays included in his new book, Fraud. You may have heard it on the public radio program This American Life. Rakoff is currently co-starring off-Broadway in Amy and David Sedaris' latest play, The Book of Liz. I asked him to explain his brief job impersonating Freud.
Well, there is a department store in New York called Barney's, which is a very fancy, trendy department store. And their windows are always, they're closer to artistic installations. And it was under the stewardship of this really brilliant art director named Simon Doonan, who turns out to be an acquaintance of mine, a friend of mine. And I asked him one October what the windows were going to be. And he said, well, they were devoted to various things. Blondes of the 20th century, Frank Sinatra, the Beat poets, Martin Luther King and Sigmund Freud. And he said, we wanted to put in a live Sigmund Freud into the window, but we can't seem to find anyone. And of course, my mind immediately, I all but pounced across the dinner table, you know, to volunteer for the job, because it just seemed like such ideal material and such a strange experience and just kind of a lark. And I volunteered. They didn't have any other volunteers, actually. And, you know, as I described myself earlier, facially, I'm not unlike Freud, you know, and I grew my little winter goatee, and I sort of looked like a young Freud. And I sat for 4 weekends before Christmas, each day, for about 4 or 5 hours, sitting in the window of Barney's department store in a kind of a mock-up of Freud's study, that was also, you know, artistically reified. There were video monitors. There was a baby carriage that had a video camera on it going back and forth on a mechanized track. There was a large black and white spiral, like the old sort of alienist hypnosis things. I mean, there was just marvelous activity in this window. And then there was me in a chair. And I started doing it. It was fascinating, but terrifying, because you're so exposed in this window, and I had nothing to do beyond read the paper and take notes of my experience and read from The Interpretation of Dreams. And I realized I couldn't do that for 5 hours a day for 4 weekends. I just couldn't do it. And so I decided to start seeing patients. And all my friends signed up, and we took it fairly seriously. They were scheduled for 45-minute sessions. And because the couch faced away from me in true psychoanalytic fashion, and because also it sort of was angled somewhat away from the window, and because there was sound insulation, we couldn't really hear the street, there was something very close and cozy, not B&B cozy, urban department store window cozy. And it was something very sequestered and cloistered about the window, and we had some actual conversations. And, you know, uncharacteristically, these weren't conversations where I was the focus. I really asked them about themselves. And it was actually kind of a strange experience, because it stopped being entirely a joke.
Now, you're the son of a psychiatrist, and your other parent you describe as a doctor who also does psychotherapy. Were you brought up with the lingo?
I was certainly brought up with the lingo, but only it's comparable to children of plumbers being conversant with the components of a toilet, but I don't know that they necessarily know more about toilets than you or I. I was brought up with the lingo, but I don't know that it was entirely part of the culture of my family. I don't come from an overly introspective family. It's not the sort of media representation of the psychiatric family.
Well, you write that you've been in therapy for many, many years. Did you initiate it or did your parents?
Oh, I did. I don't because I don't really write about my family so much. I'm a tad uncomfortable talking about my family, but I'll just say that it's not the kind of thing where in my family it's not a foregone conclusion that one would go into therapy. That was it
Right.
was definitely my choice.
What do you think has helped you more, talk or medicine?
Oh, how fascinating. Do you mean psychically, emotionally?
Just psychologically, yeah.
Talk or medicine? I think it's been a blissful combination of the two, Terry.
There's a couple of mentions of Xanax in your new book, and this is a pill that
Yes.
you take for anxiety or for panic. And I was thinking, reading your book, you have such a good, really funny grasp of every situation that you find yourself in, and you're able to really put it in a perspective, in either like an absurd perspective, or finally maybe in a more moving, reflective perspective. And so one might think, reading this, that you just have the measure of things in such an adequate way that you wouldn't need something like Xanax.
Oh, it should be noted, I don't actually take the Xanax. I keep it
Yes.
totemically on my person, not unlike a page of dialogue from Double Indemnity. The Xanax is a prophylactic, should I lose my mind? If need be, if I really need to medicate, if I'm about to freak out, I know it's there, wrapped in some tinfoil, in a little pill box, in my change purse, in my right front pocket. So it's always there. I rarely take the Xanax. Frequently, I give the Xanax. I mean, I give it to people when they're in times of trouble. So, but I've essentially had the same seven Xanax for a long, long time. I rarely take it, but just the knowledge that it's there is enough to stave off a full-blown anxiety attack. Also, I'm pretty good at, how to regulate my breathing. When I'm freaking out, I know how to do that, but I probably wouldn't know how to do that as well as I do without the sort of, it's like those very allergic people who have those pens full of, adrenaline in their wallets, not their wallets, in their purses and stuff. So they know that if they eat a peanut, they'll be able to just stab themselves with it. I'm like that.
So what's something where you actually needed the Xanax?
Oh, it's so embarrassing to admit it. All right. I had to take a Xanax. Oh my gosh, here's where I had to take a Xanax. I was sent by Harper's Bazaar to attend the couture shows in Paris, which were extraordinary. It was like one long Pepe Le Pew cartoon, which is so French and so stylish and fantastic. But what they don't tell you about the couture shows is they all start late, really late. They're all really crowded. And you are really a pawn to the designer's vision. So there was one designer who decided that the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, the Grand Hall, needed to be red. It all had to be red, 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 So we're sitting there in this incredibly crowded train station-sized room, wherein to get to your seat, you had to go over the runway and up some bleachers. You're trapped. You're literally trapped in a room full of thousands of people. The temperature is climbing steadily. There is no fire exit. It's all red, so all the windows are closed. So you're essentially in an oven. You're a rotisserie chicken. The crowds keep on coming in. The thing is not beginning. And it should be said, you're not allowed to go, even as a journalist, you're not allowed to go to the couture shows dressed in normal clothing. You have to wear a suit in July in Paris, in France, where air conditioning is not the kind of American obsession. You know, so the heat is rapidly rising, and I think, I am going to lose my mind. And so I actually took a Xanax before the that show, because I really needed one.
But did the Xanax dim your powers of perception that you needed for the piece?
Not even. And, you know, I think that I had actually had the Xanax for so long that they didn't even work physiologically. But just the fact that I had actually allowed a bit of chalky substance to dissolve under my tongue. I mean, it could have been chalk, for all I knew, helped me maintain. And it didn't impede my note-taking capacities either. So, in fact, I think that I'm traveling around with 7 little pieces of water-soluble, saliva-soluble gravel in my wallet.
My guest is writer David Rakoff. His new collection of essays is called Fraud. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Rakoff is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays called Fraud, and you might recognize his voice from This American Life, where he's a regular contributor. One of your pieces is about when you were in your 20s and you were diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which is a form of lymph cancer, and you required chemotherapy and radiation. How are you at being sick and at dealing with pain and weakness and fear?
Well, I am... How am I now?
No, how are you then?
How was I then? Then I was... and I say this in not a remotely complimentary way, I was adept at it. I was iron-fisted and funny and bright and kind of adamantine in this impermeable way. So to the world at large, I think I manifested as being eminently humorous and terrifically stoic. Internally, I was similarly so. I was never bored with myself. I mean, my mind was racing. I mean, that was really one of the astonishing aspects of it. I simply had something to think about all the time. You know, there was no staring off into space during that year and a half of my life. But in terms of the larger questions of possible mortality or illness or whatever, they didn't come up. They didn't bubble to the surface. My pond, such as it was iced over very efficiently. And certainly there was the unfortunate dividend was that once it was over, I experienced a bit of a collapse. You know, I guess it's much like that old mythic story of the mothers who can lift cars off their babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it must be hell on their rotator cuffs the next day. You know, it's that kind of thing. It was, but I was very funny that year in the worst kind of way.
Did you see yourself as Camille at all?
No. I'm,
Not that she was funny.
No, you mean sort of languishing neurasthenically against starched white sheets while the wind blows
and
through the curtains?
And being just remarkably, you know, just like beautiful and adored and...
The only Camille... I felt adored. Certainly I was the subject of great adoration, and that was in part due to the fact that it's cosmetically far more attractive to be funny and stoic and brittly witty than it is to be coughing and vomiting. You know, people enjoy people enjoy being around somebody who makes, you know, Eve Arden-like jokes about their own illness. In terms of beauty, it's interesting you say that. There was a point at which I was extremely thin. I'm 5'10", and I was down to about 115 pounds. And at that point, the illness was fairly...
That's skeletal. That's not thin.
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't really entirely understand how progressed the illness was for various reasons. It's easy to sort of lose sight of goals and such like that. But I was so thin, and also my brain was clearly, you know, decompensating in some certain way. But I felt so attractive. It's a terrible thing to admit. and it sends a terrible lesson to our nation's young people. But I really did feel, at 5'10 and 115 pounds, I thought I just looked fantastic. I couldn't stop looking at myself.
That's kind of strange, no? Because it sounds like, because you were beyond thin. I mean, looking back now.
Mm-hmm. You mean when I see photographs of myself, do I get scared?
Well, do you still think you looked real good at 115 pounds?
Sadly, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I'm not proud to admit that.
You write in your book, one of the central dramas of your life is about staying thin. I thought maybe that would have mattered to you less after nearly wasting away.
I would love to say that it mattered to me less, and it probably does matter to me less. Certainly, I'd rather go on living than waste away and die. And to say otherwise would merely be glib reductionism. But what's really rather interesting about experiences wherein one, I guess, whether you like to admit it at the time or not, faces one's mortality, is that there's an impermeable membrane. You know, you're either in the land of the sick or you're in the land of the well. And for a good few months after I became well, you know, after the final diagnostic measure, and they cut me open and took out a scarred, burnt-out lymph node that was, you know, all like a used flash bulb, you know, that the chemo had worked its magic on it, and it was now a vestigial whatever, no longer able to hurt me. So I was deemed well. For a few months after that, or maybe a few years after that, I was capable of still understanding the world of the ill. You know, I could understand that. But even when you're in the world of the ill, it's not a 24/7 kind of thing. You know, when I was first diagnosed, I thought, that's it. I'm not engaging in any more of that social crap. I'm going to call him as I see him, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, a day later, I was like, great dress. You know, so you can't not do that. You can't stop. It's too, I guess, the life force and all the artifices associated with it. It's a very powerful structure. So, you know, the impulse to be skinny, such as it is, and for whatever bundled, you know, impulses and sicknesses that speaks to, it's not, you know, it's not entirely counteracted by the fact that I once was sick. I also have a strange relationship to the nature of my illness.
What do you mean?
Well, it was, you know, I wasn't as sick as some people are or can get. You know, I had a highly curable form of cancer.
Well,
I mean, even saying cancer is sort of seems, I mean, it's in the book, and I'm not joking when I wrote it. Saying that word seems melodramatic in a way.
Yeah, well, you still were pretty darn sick and went through chemo and radiation, so...
Yeah.
Yes, no point in making too light of that. I have one last question for you. I think you're really funny. And I'm wondering if you can kind of mentally keep yourself amused when you're kind of alone with time on your hands.
Oh, yeah, I'm terrific company for myself. I can just, you know, sit there giggling all the live long day. No, it's yeah, I do think generally my twin impulses of the two default directories of my emotional life are to either make jokes about something or to be sad about something.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes simultaneously. Sad jokes.
And does your therapist ever say, this humor is a defense mechanism, you must pierce through it and get to the emotion behind it?
Sure. Yes. Yes, definitely. But I will say with no fear of contradiction, I was his funniest client. And I essentially made him admit as much at one point. But, you know, it's also, that's only part of the work, you know. But, yeah, certainly, humor is a complete defense mechanism.
But that's okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what are you going to do without your defense mechanisms? You know, that's what makes one human, I think.
David Rakoff, his new collection of funny essays is called Fraud.